Welcome to the Dropsite News Tuesday morning live stream. I'm your host this week, Murtaza Hossein. We have a great show this week. We're going to be joined shortly by my colleague, Waqas Ahmed, to talk about Pakistan and ongoing developments there, and in particular, the failing health of the country's former prime minister, imprisoned former prime minister, Imran Khan, as well as the growing authoritarianism in Pakistan, which we've been covering at Dropsite for quite some time now. But it's actually escalated quite precipitously in recent months. And later, we're going to be joined as well by Esfandyar Batmanghalij. Esfandyar is an Iranian economist and the head of the Bourse and Bazaar Foundation, an economic think tank, to talk about some of the impacts of the U.S. siege and sanctions on Iran at the moment and how those economic conditions may affect the outcome of the conflict and how much runway both the Iranians and the U.S. have in terms of economic pain they can endure in the current situation. But first, you know, coming back to Pakistan a bit, you know, at Dropsite, we've been covering Pakistan quite extensively since our inception and even before that. The crackdown on Imran Khan's party, the shutdown of democracy, a killing of protesters, a killing of people protesting against Pakistan's perceived normalization with Israel under this current military dictatorship. That situation has gotten so much worse on all accounts in recent months. First with Khan himself, his imprisonment's continued. He's being held in basically torturous conditions. Some reports have said that he's lost eyesight in one of his eyes. Maybe he has 15% residual eyesight in his right eye as a result of the conditions that he's being kept in. And likewise, he's been denied access to his family members, denied access to legal representation and so forth. And there are great fears that he may actually pass away in prison as a result of these conditions. At the same time, the military junta, which is backed by the Trump administration and by the U.S. government, it's been increasingly violent towards Pakistanis across the country who've been protesting not just the conditions of Khan's imprisonment and the crackdown on his party, but also general protests against for electoral reform, against military suppression in other parts of the country, like Kashmir or Balochistan and so forth. And really, we're seeing Pakistan devolve into a military dictatorship of an intensity and cruelty that may be unheard of in the country's history. And that's saying something given the type of dictatorships that have existed there in the past. So we're going to talk about that with a bit with Waqas starting off. I think, Waqas, you can come on at the moment as well. Thanks for joining us today, Waqas. Oh, I think your sound is muted at the moment. Waqas, yeah, we can hear you now. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, Murtaza.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. First, Waqas, can you tell us a bit about what's going on with Imran Khan at the moment? You know, I mentioned that he had actually been taken to hospital recently for some treatment. And there's great concerns that his health is maybe reaching a critical stage. He's 73 years old at the moment. He's been in solitary confinement for something like 2 years in prison in pretty bad conditions. What do we know about his condition at the moment? And where is he now?
He's in jail right now. He's back in prison. The Pakistani Supreme Court last week said that Imran Khan needs to be shifted to the hospital because a team of doctors sent by the Supreme Court went and checked him out inside the prison, and they determined that he needs to be shifted to the hospital. But the Pakistani government is completely refusing to do that because they are afraid that once he goes to the hospital, there might be images of him that might come out, that might galvanize the people around him once again. People who have not seen him for around 2 years. Imran Khan has been on Pakistani TV for the past 50 years, almost every day, almost every week on some TV channel. He used to be a cricketer. And this stretch of like 2-3 years is the only time in like the longest history of Pakistan when Imran Khan has not been seen in public. A much beloved figure in 2024 elections, 2 years ago, his party won the elections in Pakistan, and the Pakistan military had to rig those elections to turn the tide. And now they've put him in jail. He's been in jail. He's been in solitary confinement. Nobody's allowed to visit him. His sisters are not allowed to visit him. He used to get, like, in early part of his imprisonment, he used to get books delivered to his cell. He's not getting those books. He used to get newspapers delivered to him. He's not getting those newspapers. Early part of his imprisonment, he used to get 1 or 2 hours of exercise where they would let him out of his cell and he could walk around, you know, get some sun, like you, basic human rights of prisoners. He's not being given that right of exercise. This is a person who's been, you know, exercising every day of his life for, like, since he's a sportsman. So he's been doing that. And all of these basic necessities have been denied to him. This has culminated into his health deteriorating, his heart. He has now heart issues. He has extreme anxiety, which is making the heart issues worse. And also he has almost lost sight in one of his eyes.
You know, for people who have been following our reporting on this subject last few years, or maybe haven't been following it, Imran Khan's imprisonment and his removal from power was very tied to his interactions, or Pakistani military's interactions, with the U.S. government. And I know, Waqas, you, me, and Ryan, we published the story, the Cypher document, which showed that the U.S. State Department pressure had led to Imran Khan's removal, or heavily contributed to his removal from power in 2024. So can you tell us a bit about actually what the U.S. government stance towards Pakistan has been during this time? Because there were some hopes among, I think, some Pakistani Americans and others that perhaps the Trump administration would reverse some of the policies that Biden had taken, which actually did precipitate this hostility towards Khan and his party and renewed embrace of the military. What exactly is the U.S. government stance towards Pakistan at the moment? And also, you know, building on that, Pakistan currently is engaged in escalated war in Afghanistan against the Taliban. And we've also reported a bit about the Pakistan's ties to the U.S. government and how maybe shared interest in promoting a war there. What is the current nexus between the U.S. government, the Trump administration, and the military vis-a-vis Pakistan, and how it may pertain to Khan and his party?
Yeah, Murtaza, we reported how Biden administration helped the Pakistani military take over the Pakistani democracy, basically, do a coup against the elected prime minister, remove him, send him to prison. Pakistani diaspora in America were really not completely unhappy with Biden administration. And what happened after that was they started endorsing, like, big groups like PAKPAK and like these big organized committees of Pakistani diasporas in America. They started supporting the Trump election campaign and they contributed a lot to it. So when Trump got elected, there was hope that he was going to help. But at the same time, the Pakistani military got spooked immediately. They spent millions of dollars in PR in the first year of Trump administration. They spent a lot of money. They reached out to Trump and, like, everything, if you remember in those days, like last year, that's not long ago, everything that Trump used to do, the Pakistani military used to come forward, a Pakistani regime overall. So this Pakistani prime minister used to, like, recite poems about Trump, and they agreed to sending forces into Gaza. And when Trump was interested in minerals, they produced minerals somewhere, you know, even though Pakistan doesn't have those minerals, but it's all games and, like, getting closer to Trump. So they really got close to Trump, and Trump understood that. Trump realized that he has so much leverage over Pakistan, and these Pakistani diaspora has already contributed. They're not useful for the next 4 years. Useful for the next 4 years is Pakistan's army chief. And that gamble, to his credit, did pay off. So Pakistan, in the past whole year, this Iran war, has been extremely useful to Trump. It is the most allied ally of America. Whatever weird idea Trump comes up with, he has one sounding board who is like, yes, sir, I agree with you. And that is the Pakistani prime minister. He says these things publicly without any embarrassment. Like, the whole world gets embarrassed to hear him, but, like, he doesn't really care. He gives Trump what he wants. Today, the Pakistani military chief just returned from Iran. He was on a visit for taking Trump's message of restarting the negotiations, whatever the terms were he was taking to them. So he went to Iran. And apparently, he left that trip early, so Iranians were not really happy with him, because they've also started seeing them more aligned with the U.S. than as a neutral mediator. They don't see that anymore. And it really has been helpful for Trump to have some kind of neutral acting mediator who's actually behind the scenes, aligned with the U.S. or completely dependent on the U.S. administration, who's going to follow orders, who's right next door to Iran. And then there's, you mentioned Afghanistan, there's a major administration policy to get back into Afghanistan somehow. Not boots on the ground, but to get some things out of the Taliban that they have failed to do over the past few years. One of those things is to get the weapons that they left. So Trump admin feels that Biden botched the exit and he left a lot of weapons in there that fell into wrong hands. In 2025, the Pakistani military lobbied with the Trump administration and saying that we will remove all those weapons for you. Now, the ways to remove weapons is there are very few ways to remove weapons. One is you destroy them or you make the other side use them. And the Pakistani military is doing both. Pakistani military has been bombing warehouses in Afghanistan. And to bomb these warehouses, to bomb these places, they've been creating flimsy pretexts. And they've also been inciting a war with Afghanistan so that the Taliban also start attacking Pakistan and engage them in a war so that these weapons get consumed. It's such a small objective for such a big thing that they're doing. But this is in the documents. They've filed this with the Trump administration.
Yeah, and people watching, go back to look at some of our reporting, the Pakistani military in the past actually pitched itself to the Trump administration as a counterterrorism partner, quote unquote, in Afghanistan after the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. Obviously, the withdrawal was very embarrassing, and the way it went down, the images of people fleeing at the airport and so forth, and the Taliban takeover of Kabul, it was a very politically traumatic event for certain sections of the American elite. Pakistani military especially has a very keen sense of what the needs and interests are of American politicians and American elites and so forth. They pitched the idea that after the U.S. left, they will provide this over-the-horizon strike support and counterterrorism support to help fight ostensibly ISIS and other groups, including the Taliban, inside Afghanistan. So did it really, in a way, help trigger the war? And the reciprocation that they wanted was that the U.S. would resume U.S. military aid to Pakistan, which had been severed, I believe, under the first Trump administration. Renew that partnership, and they really value this embrace that the Trump administration has given them. Even the photo ops at the White House and so forth, the praise lavished on Shehbaz Sharif and Asim Manir and so forth from Trump and other American officials, it has a lot of currency to them. It doesn't really seem to benefit Pakistan as a country much in aggregate, but they value those relationships and they value that sort of attention and support from U.S. Ruling establishment. It's kind of interesting point because the Pakistani military is a colonial institution. It was actually founded under the British period. So they have a natural inclination to be in awe of the West because they were sort of created by the West institutionally at some point in the past. And they still have that sort of emotional and cultural connection to British and American elites especially. So, you know, we're in a position now also where the country is facing tremendous economic damage at the moment. First, from the misrule by the government, which the military has never really been adept at running the Pakistani economy. It's not really its core competency. But also, Pakistan is being hit very hard by the Iran war and the shutdown of the Strait of Hormuz. A lot of Asian countries were more sensitive to the impact of disruptions there. But Pakistan, especially because it's a major natural gas importer, especially from Qatar, and that's all been severed or heavily disrupted at the moment. The situation is bad even before the war, but it's been compounded significantly. I've been talking to people in Pakistan during the war and discussing like inflation and so forth. Some people are not even driving to visit family in the same city because they have to ration how much they fill up gas, the way that people in the U.S. might think about a flight. Driving has become like that for even middle-class people in Pakistan at the moment. And at the same time, Waqas, as you pointed out, the Pakistani military and government has become this trusted interlocutor for the Trump administration in the talks. And normally, if you are a mediating party during the war, it's very important that you are perceived as neutral by both sides because they both need to trust you the way that you portray even their positions will be for the purpose of neutral and judicious arbitration or solving of the problems between the two sides. It seems like the Pakistani military has been more trying to accomplish Trump's goal of achieving a deal and also a face-saving deal that he can portray as something which is either a victory or at least, you know, as I said, allows him to save face in the conflict. So we've seen several times where the Pakistani side has quite vocally said that a deal is imminent, it's at hand. They've hyped up the entire negotiation process and mediation process and the prospects of a resolution pretty much almost nonstop since April, maybe nonstop with a bit of exaggeration, but repeatedly since April. And yet no deal has come to fruition. And I think this week as well, too, there were statements by Pakistani officials saying that a deal is more or less imminent, which has helped global markets, which has been something that Trump has been trying to manage during the war. But it clearly has not been true. Can you talk a bit about first, the economic interest Pakistan has in the war and the impact of the war, but also what the role Pakistan's actually played effectively as a mediator in the negotiations?
The economic impact is huge. In the initial parts of the part of the war, when all the supplies stopped, Pakistan had to shut down schools, offices. Everyone was it was COVID all over again. They put on the same COVID restrictions, and everyone was working from home. Now the fuel is really expensive, and it was already, even before the war, Pakistan was one of the few countries that had sent millions of people back into poverty. Pakistan was sending people, like, there was a report just before the war that Pakistan had sent like around 30% more people from the middle class back into poverty in the past four years. And that was really bad. So that's millions and millions of people going below poverty line, once being considered middle class. So the war exacerbated it. It got really bad. But Pakistani military and leadership's role throughout that is been extremely weird, because they do not seem to be really concerned about the impact on the Pakistani poor. They were really excited about the prospect of being a part of this another major geopolitical game. So this is, I think, the core aspect of the Pakistani political identity as it relates to the world. It always looks outside to be a role player in global geopolitics while ignoring what's happening in its own home, because that's the way the Pakistani elite feel useful and relevant to global happenings. And they, and especially Pakistani military, they feel close to the global elite. And that's the only way they could do it, to leverage their geopolitical position. Like, these things fall into Pakistani lap. Trump didn't go to Pakistan, or Iran didn't like agree to negotiate through Pakistan because Pakistan is considered the best mediator in the world. It is because it's there. And being there is a lottery for the Pakistani generals. It makes them relevant. It makes them able to ignore it. The ability to ignore your own populace comes from this attention they get from the outside and the little breadcrumbs that come with it. And the legitimacy that comes with it, that allows them to ignore their own population and play a global role. So for a lot of countries, people who are not into really Pakistani politics, you know, go to Malaysia or Indonesia, ask a regular person over there, and they'll think that Pakistan is playing this mediatory role and with Iran and USA, and Pakistan is a really important country. But if you go inside Pakistan, there's no electricity for like 6 hours straight in a really nice neighborhood. And you can't go to school, you can't do basic things. There's no water because there's no electric motor that you can pump. All of these things are happening. For Pakistanis, it felt like, and it's still, if you look at statements that come out of Pakistan, it feels like it's not war between America and Iran. It is a wedding that Pakistan has been invited to, and it's a celebration of Pakistan. Pakistan is at the center of everything. You read Pakistani news stories like Pakistan, all eyes on Pakistan. Pakistan at the center of everything. You would not think that the war is between Iran and America. It's like something central to Pakistan has happened, and they're really, really excited about it, which also makes them extremely non-serious. So you read Pakistani reports, they're like, the deal is really close. The deal is really close. And you talk to Americans or Iranians, and they're saying there's no deal because they're both firing missiles at each other. The Hormuz is still closed. The whole global economy is destroyed. So, but if you listen to Pakistan, because their interest is in their self-promotion and projection and legitimacy of the regime.
Yeah, it's interesting. When the talks were happening in Islamabad, it was almost set up like a wedding in the sense that there were musicians and, you know, there was this gala almost, people being invited and so forth. It didn't have the gravity and the seriousness one would expect from a negotiation over a very devastating war that killed many thousands of people. Also, it didn't actually result in anything. That there was no substantive progress out of the negotiation and so forth. You know, at the same time, you know, what you're pointing out is very important, Waqas, because as the situation in Pakistan is deteriorating very precipitously, and I want to talk a bit more about that shortly, Pakistan's geopolitical stature, at least in theory, is rising very quickly. And we talked about that in the context of the U.S. and Pakistan, but also there's parallel and probably very related. There's this growing integration between the Gulf Arab states and Pakistan, particularly Saudi Arabia, and also Turkey, and the formation of this Mecca Pact or Mecca Alliance, which may be coming to fruition now. That pact, ostensibly, in the words of Turkish officials and Pakistani officials and Saudi officials, would maybe entail some sort of NATO Article 5 like mutual defense provisions between the countries, and also seemingly more realistically would also have joint defense projects, maybe standardization of defense production so that the militaries can be interoperable and so forth. And it suggests some sort of growing alignment between them. I'm kind of curious your take about this agreement and what it may signify, because, you know, you and I have also reported in the past on, you know, a drop site reported in the past on some Pakistani-Saudi previous iterations of this deal, where Pakistan and Saudi have had these defense arrangements for a long time. We published some documents or some story based on some documents showing what that entailed in practice. I remember looking at the documents and thinking that this was not as far-reaching and as substantive as it had been portrayed in the public. It seemed more like a very limited deal where Pakistan would really be defending Saudi Arabia. What Pakistan was getting out of the deal was not exactly clear, but seemed more like financial remuneration, maybe even for particular Pakistani officials. And at least at that time, 2022, there was not much indication that this was evolving into like a NATO-like arrangement. I'm curious what your take is of this new arrangement between Pakistan, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. And do you think it's more substantive than that? And it may actually evolve into something which is more geopolitically relevant.
Well, the pieces are in place, the structure is set up. And once the structure is set up, an institution of sorts is built, it can grow. There is always a possibility of things growing from there. But right now, the agreement itself, and even the Saudi agreement, which we saw, wasn't really clear. They use a lot of hedging language about, like, they're not really specific. For example, if, and they say, like, war on one would be considered war on all of them. So right now, Turkey is being targeted, and Turkish military is being targeted in Syria by Israel. Saudi Arabia is being targeted by Houthis from Yemen. And Pakistan is facing a war right now with Afghanistan. And in all of these three, nobody else is coming to help them. Like, Saudi Arabia isn't helping Pakistan with the Taliban, or even India, the war that happened last year. And Pakistan is not helping Turkey with the Syrian problem. Pakistan is not sending forces to stop Israel from infiltrating into Syria. And Pakistan is also not exactly helping Saudi Arabia with Yemen. So it's all on paper for now. But what's on paper, it seems like these are really early part, because you see, there was one, there were two announcements with Saudi Arabia. There was one a few years ago that there's going to be military alliance with Saudi Arabia. Then there was another when they finally announced the alliance, and now they're announcing the alliance. So this seems like a phase where everyone's signing documents. There's going to be no action for now. Everyone is just signing documents and watch and wait to see what appears later, because this whole area, this whole region is in a flux of sorts. So everyone's starting to figure out what we can put on paper now so that something might be needed later. But I don't know how well that would play out, because all of these countries have their own obligations and issues. Like Pakistan cannot go against Israel because Pakistan is completely dependent on America. And for the foreseeable future, for the next 20, 30 years, Pakistan will not be able to remove its dependency on America. Pakistan cannot do much with the Iran problem for Saudi Arabia because Pakistan is a next door neighbor of Iran. Pakistan has 20-30% Shia population, which feels great affinity towards Iran. They will not allow Pakistan to have any sort of military action against Iran. So all of their wishes, like Saudi wishes, Turkish wishes, or Pakistani wishes, have blockers from each other. So these alliances are not that simple.
And I wanted to pivot back in that context to Imran Khan as well, too, because this abrupt face, about face in Pakistani foreign policy really came about in the wake of his removal from power and his subsequent imprisonment. So, you know, at the time that Imran Khan was in power, he was quite critical of, first of all, his political career was really started by his opposition to the U.S. drone program, as well as some philanthropic projects he'd done inside Pakistan, which had continued to boost his status as a private citizen, in addition to being a famous cricketer and so forth. But while in office, he tried to chart a very different foreign policy where Pakistan was not hostile to the United States, but it was more neutral and independent. And I think that he also was trying to be more like what India is attempting to be vis-a-vis the U.S., where it has a relationship and has some sort of economic ties and cooperation, but it does not feel incumbent upon itself to echo American foreign policy preferences on issues where its views differ. And one of the major precipitating events around that time, when Khan, towards the end of Khan's tenure in power, was the Russia-Ukraine war and the pressure that South Asian countries, including Pakistan, were facing to take a side more directly in that conflict. He declined to do that. He said that Pakistan would remain neutral in the conflict. They wanted to have ties with Russia and Ukraine. Things have changed now since he's been in prison. In addition to everything we talked about with the Iran and so forth, Pakistan now is more supportive explicitly of Ukraine's position in the war. You know, how did the Khan's removal from power and subsequent imprisonment, which continues to this day, affect the course of U.S.-Pakistan relations? And where do you think it may have been otherwise had that not happened? Because it seems like it would have been quite different. And in a way, the pressure that the U.S. exerted to have him removed from power and maybe even put in jail did actually serve U.S. interests, because it returned Pakistan to a level or the position where it was not neutral but was aggressively supporting American interests, whatever they may be in the short term, in the region and beyond. I'm curious your take about that.
You know those Netflix murder mysteries in which some person gets murdered and then the detective has to solve that murder, and everyone, all of the characters in that show, all of them have some reason or the other to murder the character, so the detective is really confused and he doesn't know which one is it, so he has to investigate. That's the situation with Imran Khan. All of the regional actors were not really happy with him. The U.S. wasn't really happy with him because he wasn't helping with Afghanistan, and he was more of a nationalistic, patriotic leader in which he was like considering Pakistan's interests before American interests or any before wanting to be part of geopolitical game. And then there was Saudi Arabia. Now there's like really interesting thing. There you can make a case that Saudis wanted him gone. You can make a case that UAE wanted him gone. You can make like all kinds of cases because they're all valid in a way. With Saudis, Imran Khan floated the idea that there should be sort of a Muslim alliance of a Muslim NATO. And he got Erdogan on board and he got Mahathir Mohamad on board. So he wanted Pakistan, Turkey, Malaysia, and he wanted MBS on board also. But MBS at that point, and it was a big scandal at that time, if you look it up, MBS was really unhappy with him. Imran Khan was supposed to go to visit Malaysia to finalize this agreement between Turkey, Malaysia, and Pakistan and start a TV channel initially so that you could project the Muslim point of view to through the world and talk about Islamophobia and then raise that into sort of, you know, Islamic NATO-like alliance that they are talking about right now. But MBS was completely unhappy with it because he thought that Saudi would not have the leadership role in it. And he did not want anyone else to be allied. And now that thinking back to it, it's strange that MBS has gone with Erdogan again after, you know, after a period of both of these countries having really cool relationships, Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Now, he's decided to join an alliance with Pakistan, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. So he must have had some kind of approval from the West to do so, without which this would not be possible. The earlier thing that Imran Khan was trying to do was not approved by the West, which did not materialize because of that. So Saudis were not happy. And then there's UAE. UAE is a complete spoiler in the Gulf. They were also not happy with Imran Khan because UAE's sole interest in the region is to let Israel in, to open this up to, as a, you know, Israeli economic interests should be allowed in the Gulf, all of these things that UAE has been doing. So Imran Khan was also not on board. There was an extreme pressure on Imran Khan. When he was prime minister, I used to hear about that from various sources, that there's pressure on him to recognize Israel. And really close advisors to Imran Khan used to tell him to recognize Israel. Some of this pressure used to come from the UAE, that, you know, things economically would open up for you if you recognize Israel. And he was resisting all of these things. He was resisting recognizing Israel. He was not playing well with MBS in the way that he floated this idea without his approval, which he didn't want to be a part of at that time. And then there was the Pakistani military that he was. So this character of Imran Khan was that he would not listen, in the sense that he would not follow other people's demands or orders or expectations of him from a position of weakness. You know, the current Pakistani prime minister gave a statement very early on in his tenure. He said, "Beggars cannot be choosers." This is like his attitude towards life, that Pakistan, since it's a very poor country, it's a beggar, we cannot choose our foreign policy and we have to go along with these games. We have to go along with UAE. We have to go along with Saudi Arabia and USA. But Imran Khan had a completely different outlook on life. It's his personality. It's not foreign policy or politics. It's him as a person. He did not think that he was a beggar or that as a beggar, he has no ability to choose. He wanted to choose for Pakistan and to go after what he considered was Pakistani self-interest, which has now been completely removed from the equation. So now the Pakistani field marshal and the Pakistani prime minister, they do whatever Donald Trump or the MBS tells them to do.
You know, Waqas, I want to actually ask you a little bit more about that point, because it was a very important aspect you raised, which is the nature of Khan himself and his personal background and his personality and how that actually informed his view of foreign policy, it seems, when he was prime minister, and even his campaign against the drone program and so forth. Because Imran Khan, as people who are watching may know, he was somebody who spent a lot of his time in the West, and he actually was very much formed by his interactions with people in the West. He was part of the Western elite, which is rare for a Pakistani, rare for really anyone outside of from a different part of the world to really be embedded in the way that he was. And he didn't have this inferiority complex that seems like a lot of currently existing Pakistani elites have vis-a-vis the West. The term you use about the beggars can't be choosers, that's just one of many you know, interesting phrases used by the current Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif and others of people like him in his class. I think that if you also look in recent months, the way that they talk about Trump and the way that they talk about other American officials, the fawning praise over the top, you know, sort of, I don't even know how to put it, just unbelievably disgraceful and undignified manner of talking about American leaders in public, at the Board of Peace and so forth as well. praising him for being the savior of South Asia and things like this. Very debasing behavior. Imran Khan never engaged in anything like that. He wasn't hostile to the West at all. But he kind of saw himself as an equal, and he didn't really have the beggars can't be choosers attitude, or even the idea that he or the country he represented was a beggar. And he kind of acted and demanded a sort of reciprocity and equality, which maybe was antagonizing to certain American officials or European officials who are used to the obsequious sort of characteristics and behavior we see from the current Pakistani leadership. So, you know, I don't think he would have joined the Board of Peace, or he may have hesitated to do so. And if he was mediating the Iran conflict, or if he was even out of in office during the Gaza war, I'm sure that Pakistan's attitude and rhetoric and position would be quite different, and it would test the thesis of how far Pakistan can go in its autonomy and so forth. And, you know, if you look at India, for instance, it's been a bit more autonomous vis-a-vis some of these subjects, at least with the United States. It's been punished to some degree by the U.S. for that. Pakistan currently is the favored South Asian country because it's been so obedient under the military and the current civilian leadership. But it's come at the cost of many other things, the long-term stability of the country, you know, diplomatic stature and so forth, the view of its being independent, and the way it can actually engage in the foreign policy and diplomacy without having to have American acquiescence to that. Which brings me to the next point, which is that when Khan was in office, he was very popular across a different cross-section of Pakistani society, and people who were suffered from the war on terror, upper-class people lower class who saw him as promising, you know, more economic redistribution and so forth, across cultural lines and across status, you know, class lines. He was quite a unifying figure for many, many people, not for the entire country, but for quite an interesting cross-section who united around his PTI party. That party has been heavily suppressed, but also what's happened since he's been removed from power and in jail is that the country seems to be fraying apart in many ways. In Balochistan, in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, and also even in Kashmir recently. We saw our colleague Ariba Fatima filed a very disturbing and interesting report about the Pakistani military's crackdowns on electoral reform protesters in Kashmir, killing people pretty much brazenly in a part of the country that the entire creation of Pakistan was sort of based on helping liberate those people, or the Pakistani foreign policy, at least for the last many decades since independence, has been about liberation of Kashmir from what they see as Indian control of the part of the province. But now they're killing the same people. The military is killing those people for pretty much no reason, just for demanding any sort of electoral reform to the country and equal say in representation inside Pakistan. Can you talk a bit about the fraying apart of the country recently and how violence seems to be the default mode of responding to any dissent after the crushing of Imran Khan's party using great violence, including torture, and the killing of some of its members?
Yeah, it sounds dramatic, but it feels like Imran Khan was holding the country together in a way, and not because of some his like grand strategy or his ideas or anything that he was doing. It was because of who he was. There's a whole generation of Pakistanis that grew up watching him, and that is from Kashmir, from Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, Balochistan, Sindh, Punjab, all of the regions of Pakistan. Kids in the 90s and the 80s, they grew up watching him. They recognized him as a good person, as a useful person, as a leader of a Pakistani sports team, which eventually translated into his philanthropic works and like his politics. But he was a recognized known figure. And due to that recognition, he was someone that everyone else could relate to. The convergence of the Pakistani culture and society because he was such a central sports figure, he was also a central figure in Pakistani culture. He was the one who introduced Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan to the world in a way that Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan became super famous because he was invited by Imran Khan into one of his like Shokat Khanam fundraising. Like when he was raising funds for his cancer hospital, he invited this massive Pakistani, you know, cultural star, a musician, to his event, which introduced him to the world. And like then other people started, you know. So he was a central part of the Pakistani culture, but the whole Pakistani experience. And now you've removed it. That he was like one person that everyone could recognize. But since the last 20, 30 years, the nature of how culture has become fragmented, how media has become fragmented, it's become hard to find people that everyone could converge on, that everyone could agree with. So he is basically one of the last figures, like how we imagine Michael Jackson is one of the last biggest stars that people from all kinds of like backgrounds could converge on. That was Imran Khan for Pakistan, and now he's gone. He was also holding things together in the sense that he was talking about political unity and Pakistani nationalism. So Pakistan is plagued by multiple sub-nationalism. There's Punjabi nationalism, there's Sindhi nationalism, there's Pakhtun nationalism, Balochistan nationalism. These are all forces that are pushing Pakistan apart. There's like centrifugal forces that are always trying to balkanize Pakistan just by the nature of their existence. And this gives a challenge to the Pakistani, like central federal government, to keep these provinces together. And Imran Khan was the one that could hold them all together, because there are people in Punjab, Sindh, Balochistan, Pakhtunkhwa who thought that Pakistani nationalism should be a thing. But with Imran Khan gone, everyone else has reverted back to their subnationalism. So the central idea, the cohesive force that was pulling them all together, that was counteracting this balkanizational force, is gone. And then we see those protests, like the Kashmir protest is unheard of in Pakistan. In 70 years of Pakistani history, Pakistan used to say that Indian occupied Kashmir, in like occupied Pakistan used to call it the Indian occupied, the Indian part of Kashmir, the Kashmir that India holds. So Kashmir is divided in Pakistan and India, right? So the Kashmir that India holds is occupied and they are being denied rights. And Indian police and Indian paramilitary forces are shooting protesters on the street. When I was a child, after 9 p.m. news, we had one TV channel in Pakistan, and they showed news at 9 p.m. After 9 p.m. news, they used to show this 5-minute song and a TV segment in which they would show us videos of atrocities in Kashmir. As a child, you would see that on national TV, photos of dead bodies, bullet-ridden bodies, burning bodies from Indian Kashmir. This is what I grew up watching. And this was Pakistani state propaganda. Every night, they would do it without fail. After every newspaper, 5-minute segment, a song, and a really sad song, and photos of dead bodies. I saw photos of dead bodies now from Pakistani Kashmir for the first time in my life. And they were shot by the Pakistani military. I have not seen photos like this. So Pakistan had to occupy Kashmir because the central cohesive force, there's nothing that is for Pakistani nationalistic, patriotic Pakistanis, there's no light at the end of the tunnel. So they're reverting back to their sub-nationalisms, to their own communities, thinking that there's no future with Pakistan. A lot of middle-class, upper-class people who feel that this, they're leaving Pakistan. This is like one of the symptoms of it. So many Pakistanis have left Pakistan in the past like 1-2 years that they have not in like past 10 years. All educated people, they're going to Gulf, Europe, America. They're trying to become the illegal immigration from Pakistan has increased drastically. There are, every time there's a boat that, you know, the boats that go from Greece to the rest of like Europe, from Turkey or from North Africa to Greece or the rest of Europe, when these boats sometimes they get sunk and people unfortunately die, there are like 10%, 20% people are Pakistanis. And it's so weird, like there are people from Syria who are fleeing war. There are people from Libya fleeing war. There are people from Africa fleeing famine. And then there's people from Pakistan who have taken this risk, even though there's no famine in Pakistan, even though there's no war in Pakistan. There's like a stable government. The American government keeps saying that there's a stable government in Pakistan, but there's stability in Pakistan. But why do these Pakistanis keep turning up in boats with these war-ravaged, war-torn like countries? It's not strange when you really look at the economic situation and the hopelessness in Pakistan that has now come.
Yeah, Waqas, Aspania is going to join us in about 10 minutes. But in the time we had left, I did want to ask you something which I think is becoming more of a, unfortunately, a possibility, is that Imran Khan doesn't seem to have a light at the end of the tunnel, legally at the moment, at least. There's no... deal. They keep. They seem very politically focused on keeping him in prison in these conditions. He's also, for reasons we talked about, his health is failing, his eyesight is failing, and he's 73 years old. He's an older man, and to live in such dire conditions, it could have even more deleterious effects on his health. If Imran Khan, being who he is, and this popularity and the unifying sort of nature, his character had on many people across Pakistan, if he were to pass away in prison in these conditions after being deposed, a military coup, effective coup, which was backed by the U.S. in this case as well too, what would be the effects on Pakistan if that were to happen? And I've heard some indication that at least people in his circle are sort of floating the idea that he may accept being released while not protesting the government and so forth, which may signal a point of some sort of deal. But if that doesn't come to pass, and I'm curious what are your thoughts about how possible that is, but if that doesn't come to pass and he does die in prison, how would that affect Pakistan, and what would that mean for Pakistani nationalism as a project going forward?
Well, there is a possibility, and this is my opinion. There is nothing to back it up. I feel that the Pakistani military want him to die quietly in prison, not right now, but like in 4 or 5 years. They want him to stay there and die in actually not natural circumstances. They don't want to catalyze it. They don't want to like just there's like talk of like the military trying to give him slow poison and to make sure that like kill him in a slow way and make it seem natural. I don't think that the Pakistani military wants to do that, because any clue would point towards them. So what I feel that they want to do is they want him to die of natural causes and create conditions in which he would die of natural causes, that a doctor from Imran Khan's family can come and check him and say that he actually did die of natural causes. Because when suppose, like we say, God forbid he dies, the first thing that will happen after he dies will be people, his family will demand to see him. And when his family demands to see him, the doctors will come and they'll want to do some sort of postmortem to see what happened and to, you know, check his blood and all of those things. And at that moment, if it comes out that there was any foul play, there would be a huge liability on the Pakistani military. The volcano that has not erupted till now, there's a reason for it, and that is that Imran Khan is still alive. And Imran Khan is, and as much as the Pakistani military would like to pretend, Imran Khan is not Morsi. They want him to treat like Morsi. They want to treat him like Morsi, and they want him to die like Morsi and under mysterious circumstances immediately while the trial is going on and he's gone. They want to do that to him, but they can't, because Imran Khan is way more popular than Morsi was internally and externally. Yesterday, there were like multiple British MPs and like really British high profile people. They politicians, Imran Khan's ex-wife, who is from a big goldsmith family. He's like a really big deal in the British politics and British society. So she said that, you know, Imran Khan's rights are being denied and the British government must act. And the British government, there are indications that the British government has started listening. British government has its own limitations because they're beholden to like whatever America is doing and they can't go much further, but they are listening. They are watching. They're paying attention. They're seeing what's happening in Pakistan. So they might intervene at some level. And there's like, there are multiple other people like Imran Khan has had relationships with many other world leaders, even like MBS. MBS is not really against Imran Khan, and there are indications that he has also asked the Pakistani government to like be lenient on him or to figure out the way, because this was last year that the Saudi ambassador to Pakistan reached out to the Pakistani regime to say that there should be some sort of rapprochement between Imran Khan and the Pakistani military, so that everyone can move forward. Because right now, and this is a feeling I feel whenever I talk to any Pakistani, everything politically is at a standstill. It's frozen. It's not like things are going on. It's frozen. For the day that there's this situation, this ball that is hanging, either to come down or like to be destroyed, either for Imran Khan to die or to come out, because the situation is, it has a lot of potential energy that has to convert into kinetic energy. It's an intermediate situation. It is not a stable situation. It is a highly unstable situation that it is looking for a resolution. As long as the resolution doesn't come, the next part will not start. So the resolution would either be Imran Khan coming out, and if Imran Khan comes out, that would start its own thing. But if he dies, then that resolution would be the immediate rebellion in Pakistan. And that rebellion would also be in all layers of Pakistani state. Most dangerously, that rebellion would be in the Pakistani military. That would happen. Like, I cannot see a situation in which the Pakistani military kills Imran Khan and there's no pushback from within the Pakistani military. There are huge number of mid-level, I wouldn't even say that, the stats used to be like 4 or 5 years ago, people used to say that junior officers in Pakistani military support Imran Khan, but it's not junior anymore. These are mid-level officers, and they see what their seniors are doing. The mid-level officers who really support Imran Khan or support democracy in Pakistan, an oath that they've taken, if Imran Khan is killed, they will not sit quietly. So this is one of the reasons the Pakistani military is not crossing that line. It's still, you know, pretending that it is interested in Imran Khan's medical welfare while denying him the same. So their best bet is to keep denying him medicine so that he dies quietly of natural causes that can be demonstrated as natural by an independent and neutral doctor. That's their best bet. But who knows how things happen, you know? Things can be really weird. In Pakistan, in 1980s, there used to be a military dictator who thought that he's going to stay forever. His name was Ziaul Haq. And one fine day, he was going on a really president. He was president and army chief at the same time. He was the most powerful man in Pakistan. And his plane blew up and he died. And he thought that the presence of the American ambassador on his plane, so he forced the American ambassador to fly with him. He thought that if American ambassador is in his plane will not get blown up. But, you know, his plane still blew up, and planes blow up all the time, and things happen, and the world is weird and chaotic. So who knows how things might unfold? But we can see from Imran Khan, and that's, I think that right now, that's the only way for these things to unclog, this drain to unclog, because I don't see the Asim Munir, the Pakistani military dictator, budging, or I don't see Imran Khan as bending the knee. He will not do that. This is like the part of his personality. He will die before bending the knee. And that's the problem. That's like everyone keeps forcing him. Yet last week when he came out, when the court said, one of the theories is that the Pakistani Supreme Court, which is completely in control, by the way, by the Pakistani military, they have changed the Pakistani constitution so that the Pakistani Supreme Court listens to the Pakistani military. Pakistani Supreme Court, surprisingly, it was a big surprise that it ordered Imran Khan to be moved to the hospital. And when Imran Khan goes to the hospital and he's like told all these things, and one of the most shocking things I hear from that is Imran Khan didn't know what date it was. So he's been in solitary confinement in a way. And like, do you imagine, this is something I read from like medieval times or like early 19th century, that, you know, prisoners are in jail, solitary confinement for so long that they don't even know what date it is. So he asked what date it is. But then he eventually, I think there was some talk of him agreeing to some demands by the Pakistani military so that he could stay in the hospital for the foreseeable future. But apparently he said that he would like to go back to jail instead of like talking to Pakistani military or having anything to do with it, because he stood so long, he has taken bullets. They tried to kill him. He had like bullets in his leg and he's gone through so much. And after going through so much, then to bend the knee again, he might as well as done it in 2022 or 2023 when he had a chance, when he was still out, and you know, and it wouldn't look so bad when so many people had not died. He would have done it at that time. But since he didn't do it then, he will not do it now. So the only way is, in Pakistan, there used to be a saying, there's one grave and two people. Someone has to go in it. So that saying was between Bhutto and Ziaul-Haq, the dictator I mentioned earlier. He faced a similar situation with the elected Pakistani prime minister at that time, Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto. So Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto was the elected prime minister who was removed in a coup, and Ziaul-Haq was the military general. And they had a clash. The military general removed the prime minister, put him in jail. But the military general was really afraid. And the saying was, there's one grave and two people. Someone has to go in the grave. It's either going to be Ziaul-Haq or Bhutto. Because if Ziaul-Haq lets Bhutto come out, then Bhutto is going to put Ziaul-Haq in the grave. So Ziaul-Haq had no choice in that sense. He had to hang Bhutto, and eventually he hanged Bhutto, and Bhutto died. And there wasn't much from Pakistani societies if we look at the backlash. His son, Bhutto's son, started a terrorist organization. But really, Bhutto, if we really compare now, Bhutto probably was not as popular as Pakistan. And Pakistan was not the same Pakistan it is now. We didn't used to have the same media, same connectedness within society that we have now. To hang Imran Khan or to have him killed will not be the same as hanging Bhutto.
Yeah, Wukas, thank you for that. We're going to continue covering Pakistan at Drop Site, and we have some stories coming very imminently, in fact, that you're also working on that's will be very interesting. I will also say one very last note, and Wakas, you know this too, in the last couple of years, even before we joined Dropside, we really, me, you, and Ryan had been the only ones covering the Imran Khan saga, reporting documents and so forth. To this day, it's been basically memory-holed by the establishment media, including places that have reporters inside Pakistan correspondents. Even after the validation of the documents by the Pakistani military, they're just acting like it's not happening, which I think is very much a eye-opening experience for both of us, and as well as Ryan and everyone who works here, but also for the general public to see how blinkered this coverage can be and how they can actually ignore things which are politically inconvenient, even though they're true and documented and based on classified leaks, which have been verified and so forth. So, you know, thank you so much, Wakas, for joining us. And we're going to continue doing more coverage on Pakistan in the near future.
Thank you, Murtaza.
So our next guest, very excellent analyst, Esfandiar Batmanghalij. He's the CEO of the Bourse and Bazaar Foundation, which is an economic think tank focused on the Middle East and Central Asia. I've been reading Esfandiar's work for many, many years. And, you know, so much to discuss at the moment in terms of the escalation of the U.S. economic war against Iran, as well as the dueling sieges between Iran and the United States over the Strait of Hormuz. But, you know, Esfandiar, the first thing I want to ask you, aside from the geopolitical context, is how is this affecting ordinary people in Iran? Because the economic situation was not ideal even before the war. Inflation was a huge problem, currency depreciation. But it seems like the U.S. maximum pressure program to put pressure on the Iranian economy has entered a new phase, which we saw actually this week, at least with an announcement of intention by Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent of, you know, an economic D-Day against Iran and Operation Economic Outcast, and the suggestion that even more secondary sanctions could be coming, as well as an intensification of the blockade. You know, Esfandiar, how are people in Iran on a daily practical level experiencing the effects of these very apocalyptically framed economic policies?
Hi, Murtaza. It's good to be with you. And I mean, thanks for Starting with that question, I think it's really important that we put the Iranian people front and center when we talk about the impacts of these policies. Look, I think the way we can understand it is that, ordinary Iranians have been facing a really difficult economic environment in Iran for the better part of a decade, going back to the first Trump term when Trump withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, reimposed secondary sanctions, and in doing so, isolated Iran's economy from the global economy, really triggering what we could call an artificial balance of payments crisis. Iran had difficulty earning export revenue, principally through its oil sales, but also through non-oil exports. And even when it was earning that revenue, it was not able to freely access that money. And in turn, the country still needed a wide range of imports. This is an economy of, 90 million people. It's a pretty diversified economy. If it can't buy things from the global market, that starts to have a real impact on overall economic performance. And that combination of, export pressure on revenues and continued import demands really pushed Iran's economy into a slow-moving crisis, typified, as you pointed out, by high inflation. Now, what has that meant for ordinary people? Inflation has been above 40% for around 3 or 4 years now. And if you can just imagine, for anyone living in the US or Europe that have experienced the kind of inflation in the post-COVID moment, which was of a much lesser extent, you can see that this basically means a cost of living crisis emerging. In Iran, given the long duration, it's not just that people are struggling to afford, the standard of living that they were used to, but in many cases, households have seen their standard of living actually fall dramatically. So we see things like ordinary people who were in middle-class households finding themselves falling into sort of a working-class socioeconomic stratum, or even actually falling below the poverty line. There's been an increase in poverty in the country. I think the final thing I'd say on this, and we can unpack it more, but is that aside from the actual sort of concrete economic impacts, one of the really difficult things for Iranians has been that moments of optimism have given way to an era of pessimism. And that really deep-seated economic pessimism that we have in the country, where, and we see this actually in multiple waves of nationally representative surveys that have been conducted both in Iran and by pollsters outside, the overwhelming majority of Iranians simply believe that the economy is going to keep getting worse. And that's really kind of shading a lot of decisions that they make about, how they live their lives. And that pessimism is politically corrosive as well. So, I think overall the notion is that sanctions have definitely made ordinary Iranians poorer, but we should be asking the question of to what end. And it's not really clear that there is any overriding logic to these policies beyond exactly that outcome.
That's a very important point, Esfandiar, because the way that the policy of maximum pressure and now this economic D-Day has been discussed, it's treating the depreciation of the Iranian currency or the immiseration of the population as an outcome in itself or as a goal in itself. At least that's how it's being articulated. There's no real explanation or program for how the pressure will lead to concrete political changes or maybe change Iran's posture on negotiations over the Strait of Hormuz or the nuclear program or other issues that are in dispute between itself and the U.S. It seems like they're almost bragging about the fact that it's harming Iranians for the sake of it. But, it seems that, looking at the other cases of economic pressure and even military pressure placed against Iran and other countries, that the pressure, while immiserating the population or harming the population, it doesn't really seem to always have a political outcome. So do you think that the current economic pressure with the blockade and so forth on Iran would result in the Iranian government changing its stance on some of these issues? Or do you think that the pressure itself is just really inflicting collateral damage, inflicting harm on the population while not having a clear political end state? Because I just really struggle to find examples in history where that's been the case. Maybe there are a few, but certainly in the U.S.-Iran relationship, the pressure seems to lead Iran, in the past at least, to dig in further.
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent question. And when you ask sanctions scholars or sanctions practitioners about the you know, what is a judicious way of using these tools of economic pressure, the overwhelming thing that they would tell you is you need to have a very specific and actionable goal. That if you're intending to use sanctions to change the behavior of a target country, you need to give that country a clear idea of what behavior they're going to change, and it has to be something that's reasonable for that country to do. And the Trump administration in particular, but I actually think it's a problem that runs through both Republican and Democratic administrations, has really struggled to articulate goals that meet that sort of definition of good use of sanctions. So in the first Trump term, there was actually an effort to articulate the goals of this sanctions policy. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, when announcing the maximum pressure policy, set out 14 points that he wanted Iran to sort of abide by in order to get the sanctions lifted. It was a completely maximalist set of goals, and it was very unreasonable that Iran would do that. But at the very least, they did set out some goals. I mean, what's strange about the announcement yesterday from Secretary of Treasury Scott Bessent is that there was no articulation of the goal. And as you point out, it seems like the pain is the point. Now, the other thing I would just point to concretely is that, you know, this kind of gloating about the economic pressure, one of the examples of this is that the administration keeps pointing to the free market exchange rate, and it has crossed the psychological threshold of 2 million reals to the dollar recently. So the devaluation has been very sharp and very consequential for Iran's economy. But what is the free market exchange rate? It is not actually the exchange rate that the government uses fiscally. It's not the exchange rate that businesses use for export earnings or to receive currency allocations to pay for imports. The free market exchange rate represents the very small portion of the foreign exchange market in Iran, where individuals are trading dollars, often physical bills, in Iran at exchange houses, with the express intention of preserving their savings. So if you're an Iranian and you're earning riyals and you know it's a high inflation environment, what you want to do is not keep your savings in riyals. So you buy gold, you buy dollars, you buy euros. If you can, you buy real estate. And so when the Treasury Secretary is pointing to this exchange rate, what he's basically describing is a situation in which ordinary Iranians are having their savings crushed by this general economic malaise created by the sanctions. And, you know, there is no clear theory of change in which, you know, basically eliminating the economic welfare of families in a country equates to better political outcomes. And we have a lot of history to back this up. You know, no country experienced the more profound economic collapse in the modern era than Venezuela. And yet we have not seen a kind of, you know, utopian political change in Venezuela. In fact, you have the Trump administration working essentially with the remnants of the Maduro regime. And maybe the other example to point to is Cuba, a country that has been under a U.S. embargo for 6 decades. And there is an acute humanitarian crisis in Cuba today, and there is no pathway to constructive political change. And Iran, in some ways, is going down that path because of the insistence of the U.S. to maintain this economic isolation. And I think it is a very counterproductive policy, and it's also one that has fed into these cycles of escalation and ultimately the military confrontation we just had.
You know, Esfandiar, recently after the passing of Lindsey Graham, there was actually a bill which was put forward in his name, which would impose further sanctions, not just on Iran, but also on Russia. And it seems that there's a growing sanctioned world out there. You mentioned Cuba as well, too, and several other countries, which now, you know, a lot of global economic outcome, not maybe not a lot, but an increasing proportion of global economic output is either sanctioned or at risk of sanctions, and a lot of that is in energy-producing countries like Iran and Russia and so forth. I also saw recently, I think it was actually just 24 hours ago, in the last 24 hours, that the Chinese government said that it would not It did not recognize the legality or legitimacy of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Of course, China is a major buyer, or probably the major buyer of Iranian energy today. Does Iran have any capacity, maybe in the medium term or long term, to be able to resist these sanctions measures or mitigate the impact of them, given that there seems to be a trajectory where the more and more is sanctioned, and also maybe they have an outlet with China? Or is that not really a realistic path forward for the Iranian government?
The question is, what do we call resistance? And there are different views of this in Iran. There are certain economic policymakers that, you know, look at this really dire situation for ordinary people, and they look at that and they see a failure to mitigate the impact of the sanctions. And therefore, they are sort of raising setting out warnings about, you know, how long can Iran go down this path where basically the country's development has been forestalled. So that is one school of thought, that Iran has largely failed to mitigate the impacts. But that is the view of those in the Iranian system that are looking at it through the prism of economic development. There is also a national security consideration, and this is a highly securitized issue. The Trump administration is talking about this openly as economic warfare, and Iranian officials see it as a form of warfare. And so when they think about resistance or the response to these policies, they're thinking about a national security set of imperatives. And so for them, the question is not, can we mitigate the harm on ordinary people? The question is, how can we ensure that Iran's hard power is not eroded during the course of the conflict because of these economic measures? And that's something that I think ultimately the Iranian authorities have shown some capacity to achieve, which is that largely because they rely on fairly cheap military capabilities like ballistic missiles and drones, support for proxies, they're able to continue to pose a threat to U.S. interests in the region, even as the overall economic circumstances sort of decline. And the other thing I would just say about this is that there's an somewhat implicit but sometimes explicit aspect of U.S. policy, which is to try and instrumentalize the hardship of ordinary people, in the sense that, you know, if they basically suffer enough, they will rise up and protest and maybe overthrow the regime. But of course, from a national security standpoint, the regime has demonstrated what it will do if and when there is another round of significant protests, and that's used, you know, tremendous force to crush those protests. And so even that doesn't offer a real pathway, a realistic pathway to political change in the country. You're just basically making a more dysfunctional, divided, and in some ways dangerous country in Iran.
You know, it's funny, before you came on, we were talking about Pakistan for quite a bit. And Pakistan's example of a country which the actual citizenry is very immiserated. There's a tremendous amount of poverty, probably in excess of Iran for many reasons, including the fact that Pakistan's an energy importer. But despite that, the Pakistani military regime has gotten more and more powerful in its security apparatus domestically, but also wielding nuclear weapons, a huge air force and so forth. So the disjuncture between the population being poor and the state being rich, or at least rich enough to pose a threat to its neighbors, is really, you know, there's not much of a connection in some way. Elites are always able seemingly to find a way to satisfy their own core prerogatives. I was curious, you know, from your perspective, in the context of the current standoff, the only thesis I could see for these sanctions is that threatened sanctions is that they are trying to find a way to force Iran to concede its control of the Strait of Hormuz in a manner which at least allows a face-saving end to the war from a U.S. perspective, and also perhaps as a secondary step, maybe more unrealistically, but perhaps open up discussion again on its nuclear program and make significant concessions on enrichment and things like that, or even talk more broadly about the ballistic missile program or proxy program, which probably is much more unlikely that they're going to get to that step. But do you think that these sanctions or these threatened economic warfare measures are likely to maybe cause the Iranian establishment to coalesce in favor of offering some significant compromise? Or do you think that there's a risk also that they may escalate militarily if they feel, as you described it, that the sanctions themselves are a form of war themselves, and shooting or resuming major attacks against U.S. bases would be on a continuum with that?
My base case is that we are likely to get another round of escalation. I think the reason for this is that the economic pressure from the U.S. is going to warrant a response from Iran. And Iran interprets the Trump administration's shift from a military strategy to one of economic warfare as basically a sign of weakness, that the Trump administration lacks the resolve to continue the military operation. And basically, the baton is being passed from Hegseth and the War Department to Besant and the Treasury Department to try and give the impression that Trump still has the answers or is still in control of the situation. And so in light of that, the idea that there is a political vulnerability to further military action, and because the Trump administration continues to use the language of warfare and of pressure, you know, it's pretty straightforward for Iran to respond. But I think, Murtaza, your point is a really good one about, you know, what is it going to take to actually get the two sides together? And from the Iranian perspective, they have actually been pretty direct about this. You have across the national security leadership, whether it's the President Pezeshkian, the Speaker of the Parliament, Ghalibaf, the new head of the Supreme National Security Council, Rezaei, they have all underlined that the acceptable formula for ending the conflict is the MOU that was agreed basically 2 months ago. And the MOU stipulates commitments that the US president agreed to. He signed a document that said that steps would be taken not just to end hostilities with Iran, but also to enable Iran's reintegration in the global economy. And so Besant's announcement yesterday is diametrically opposed to the kind of win-win diplomacy that was set out in the MOU. And this is where I think it's perplexing what the administration is aiming for, because in some sense, the formula that was satisfactory for them to end the war earlier this summer, it's still viable. And in fact, the Iranians are saying this is still viable. The regional countries that helped mediate that agreement are saying this is still viable. But the administration is getting advice that for whatever reason, that is no longer a formula that they should pursue. And it might be because they're interested in face saving, as you point out. They're very concerned about not appearing that they've lost this war. But, you know, that is, I think, a weakness of this administration, where optics matter more than sound policy. And nothing reflects that better than the way that Besant approached the announcement yesterday. It was a lot of hot air, building expectations around a big expansion in the Trump administration's sanctions policy. In the end, it wasn't. There wasn't much meat there, or much specificity about what the administration is going to do. And I think that's all emblematic of quite a broken policy process within this administration. And that's not just an Iran issue. It's something we see across files, because this is an administration with a fractured cabinet, a weak interagency process, and an erratic president. And U.S. policy reflects all of those characteristics.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It reminds me of the very famous quote by Theodore Roosevelt, U.S. policymakers should talk softly and carry a big stick. It seems like the opposite is happening now. There's very bombastic, apocalyptic rhetoric, and then relatively muted actions thereafter. Like economic D-Day, you know, just resulted in more another last warning or so forth. And we've seen the cycle quite a bit now in the last few months. I want to ask you one last question. You know, I remember at the start of the war, when the Strait of Hormuz was shut down, there were very dire warnings about the long-term or even short-term economic fallout from that. And we have seen some of that. But for the most part, you know, Brent oil, you know, futures and so forth, they are elevated, but they have not reached apocalyptic levels that people had feared as yet. And the global economy, especially in Asia, has been heavily impacted. And even, of course, in Iran, but also even in the West and Europe and even in the United States, there have been inflation and other pressures. But it hasn't seemingly come to a breaking point that people feared may have come, even if this blockade had happened, continued through June and so forth. We're, you know, almost at the end of August, the Strait is not back to its normal capacity. And the global economy is staggering along to some degree. But, you know, for the final question, I'm just curious your take. If this crisis continues past the midterms, you know, to the end of the year, what may we see global economy shaping up at, and what could be close to breaking in terms of a consequence of the continued blockage of this very important global maritime artery?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting thing that historians will look back at, which is how exactly was it that this crisis didn't lead to even more profound economic disruptions? You know, part of that, I think, is actually that we sometimes underestimate how adaptive economies can be, and especially companies and firms that are operating within an economy, they are geared towards finding alternatives and solutions when challenges appear. And a lot of the lessons that we saw from COVID and the Russian invasion of Ukraine in terms of supply chain disruptions and shocks to global energy markets, those lessons allowed a lot of this adaptation in the wake of this crisis. So maybe that's actually something that is, encouraging about what we've learned about the global economy. That being said, the current state of play in the Strait, which is around 7 million barrels per day of oil leaving the Strait, down from around 20 million barrels per day before the war, what that reflects is two things: that there's a little bit of a kind of Goldilocks dimension here, where from the Iranian perspective, it is important to add enough pressure that this is a suboptimal situation for the Trump administration, that certainly with things like refined products, like diesel, there is price pressure that is continuing to be felt by consumers in the US. But at the same time, on the other hand, what they need to be careful about is not to create such an acute crisis that either for Iran itself or for its Gulf neighbors, this becomes a truly untenable situation, because Iran also wants to keep the Gulf neighbors kind of onside or somewhat neutral in this conflict, rather than pushing them to believe that they have no other choice but to engage with the US and join the US effort to decisively win this war. And I think in some ways, the current level of oil exports and the current level of economic activity in the Gulf is indicative of this effort to find a balance between maintaining pressure, but also on the US, but also giving some relief for regional economies. And that modulation, I expect, would continue even if this conflict goes on for some months, because ultimately the political vulnerability here for the US matters more than the economic vulnerability. Nothing Iran can do will be that consequential for a US consumer. The pressure Iran is adding is marginal pressure. But when it comes to the question of, is President Trump someone who looks like a commander in chief that's in control of a situation, or one that has walked into a kind of quagmire of his own making, that's where I think Iran can have more of an impact. And I believe that kind of political logic is what's going to spur Iranian action more so than the economic logic, especially as we move towards the election in November.
Esfandiar, thanks so much for joining us today. That was a really impeccable insight. And please, everyone, check out his analysis on Borsa and Bazaar and the many places he writes, and on social media as well, too. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Murtaza. Good to be with you.
Well, that does it for this week's episode of the Dropside Tuesday morning live stream. You can catch us every Tuesday at roughly 9:30 a.m. Covering global events, covering Dropside's own coverage, and also keeping you abreast of what may be coming down the line in hotspots around the world, whether it be Gaza, Iran, Syria, or other parts of the world which may be in conflict. Again, I'm your host this week, Murtaza Hossein. We'll see you next week. And please subscribe to Dropside News for all your news coverage. Like the video, share with your friends, and we'll see you very soon.